but they don't have an honorable discharge. I actually thought it was very interesting when I started looking for the data. We're talking about data. I'm a practitioner. I'm not a data person. I see about 300 veterans a year, 400 veterans a year. So I don't know the data. I know that about half of my vets are having other than honorable discharges. But when I was looking for the data, I couldn't find them. There was one Seattle article in the Seattle paper that said there were 20,000, but it didn't clarify really whether it was just the Army or whether it was the whole entire military or whether it was post 9/11 or per year, nothing. So I looked some more, and I had to do a Freedom of Information Act request to get the data, and the message I got back was that that information was so complicated they couldn't give it to me at this point in time. I would have to wait in line. So I think that says a lot just there. So let me start with telling a story of one of the veterans that I work with. I named him Eric. Obviously, everything here is sort of mixed up with to prevent breach of confidentiality. He was a sniper in Baghdad, and he did 3 tours in Iraq. So one day he was on the roof. It was a dangerous job, obviously, because the first thing you want to take out is the sniper. So he was on the edge of the roof, and with his best friend, who was also a sniper, and his best friend was taken out. Then a mortar attack happened, and the mortar went right over his shoulder and exploded just far enough behind him to blow him off the roof but not kill him. He started to develop all kinds of huge PTSD problems. He couldn't sleep anymore. He was super hypervigilant. He startled at anything and everything. He had flashbacks all the time, and he was thinking about killing himself. He asked for services from behavioral health on his base, and he was denied. In fact, his commanding officer at the time told him that anybody, told all his men and women, if they were asking for behavioral health, their driving privileges would be revoked, so they couldn't actually get there. So he started self-medicating on marijuana in order to sleep and stay calm enough and try to, in an attempt to function. And then one day he heard that there was going to be a urine drop, so people were supposed to, pee in a bottle, and they were going to test them for drugs. And his commanding officer refused to give him a bottle because he knew that he was going to come up positive for marijuana. So he had to sneak into the back door and got himself a bottle and actually got himself tested for marijuana and then got kicked out because of drug abuse. That desperation led to a bad conduct discharge. He was, anyway, it was terrible. So then he got out of the military into civilian society. This guy lives in Illinois, bad conduct discharge. He was. So here he had a service-connected injury, but he could not get the treatment anywhere. He ended up in prison, actually, this guy. So just real brief, there are a number of military discharges. Most of you might be familiar. There's the administrative, the punitive, the officer discharge, which is a little different, and then the entry-level separation. Honorable administrative discharges are the honorable discharges. Most veterans have that, and you're eligible for all benefits if you apply for them. Then there's a general under honorable conditions, and you're eligible for most benefits, not all. And then there's other than honorable conditions discharge, and you're ineligible for most. Then there's punitive discharges, that's the bad conduct discharge, and then there's the dishonorable discharge. That's when you don't have any more benefits at all. Okay. I'm just going to skip over this. All right. What's important in this little chart is that the E stands for eligible. So general and general under honorable are, you're eligible for most services. With another than honorable or a BCD, with a special court martial, you can become eligible if you jump a number of hoops, and I'll talk about that in a minute. And if you have a BCD, a bad conduct discharge, with a general court martial, you're not eligible for anything, and a dishonorable discharge, you're not eligible for anything either. So If you have an other than honorable discharge or a bad conduct discharge under special court martial, you may be considered eligible for VA medical care if you can show that you served honorably until your service-connected condition made it impossible for you to do so. Okay? So if you can prove, if you can get a doctor, psychologist, a nurse, psychiatrist to tell you, to write down that it's more likely than not that this person served honorably until a service-connected injury made it impossible for them to do so, you can be considered for VA care. This is a huge hoop because a lot of these people that have been discharged in this way because of a service-connected injury, they feel incredibly betrayed by their by the military, by their governments, and they have PTSD, often coincides with depression, obviously, have a very hard time to get all of that paperwork together. So there's a huge number of people out there in our society with other than honorable discharges and not eligible for VA care, even though they serve their country and even though they have a service-connected injury. It's a problem not just because of the VA, but it's also a problem because almost all other programs out there, and I know you're probably aware that there's funding out there for veteran services everywhere, and everybody's trying to get this service, this money, whether or not they know what they're doing. But almost always they also require an honorable or at least a general under honorable discharge. And so even if you are a veteran veteran with a discharge that makes you ineligible for VA care, it often also makes you ineligible for other care, except for a program like VVAW that's completely funded by, veterans sending in their $25 check every year to their member, to pay their membership, but that's about it. In fact, if a veteran goes to the VA and has one of those bad discharges, it says in their medical records there, this is a non-veteran. Okay, so like this guy Eric that I talked about earlier, who had been in Iraq 3 times, had been a sniper, had lost his best friend, had almost gotten killed himself, he is considered a non-veteran. Okay, talking about betrayal right there. Everybody probably here has seen the Rand report, but I think that the most important part here is that the consequences of not treating our service members and veterans is not good for that person and our society in general. Anne already talked about barriers that they don't go in for treatment, but then there's all these people who can't even go in for treatment. So let me tell you the story of Simon. Another person, he had 3 deployments, 1 to Iraq, 2 to Afghanistan. He was a driver for his commanding officer. And although he did a lot of professional driving, he was also ordered to drive for personal errands for the CO. So he was sent to go and buy cigarettes and beer. And the car was hit by an IED and his battle buddy was killed. Again, this person was denied access to mental health. So one day he walked into his CO's office and he had the gun in his face and he wanted to kill himself in front of the CO to punish the CO more than maybe himself, I'm not sure, it's hard to tell. Instead, the CO accused him of attempted assault. So there he was, he received a dishonorable discharge. So this man had lost his best buddy, 3 deployments, no benefits. Okay. I'm sure you're aware that 15% of our forces are female nowadays, okay? 33% of our female forces are being sexually assaulted. And these are only the people who speak. Personally, I have never met a female veteran who has not experienced some level of sexual assault or harassment. And that could be from, full gang rape to not daring to go to the bathroom when it's dark so you don't drink any water after noon so that you won't have to go during the night. I see some people nod their heads right here. So it's a wide range, but the fear of what could happen, the heavy, I don't know what to call it, threat that could happen, has a big impact on a lot of these women. Anyway, Margaret was deployed twice, once to Iraq and once to Afghanistan, and was sexually assaulted by a fellow soldier. She was no longer functioning due to depression, inability to show up for work due to sleep deprivation. So it's a big issue. I hear that a lot. People who are either over-medicated, I think Stephen talked about that, and are therefore not able to wake up in time in the morning to show up, or it's people who just cannot sleep till 4 in the morning, and then when they finally fall asleep, they are so out that they're not getting up in time to present in the morning. And then they get an Article 15, and then they get the whole disciplinary action. And she had anxiety attacks on base. She tried to report the assault, but was not provided with support to do this. So what she did, she went AWOL. She went AWOL to try to get help. It's very important when you come across people who have gone AWOL because they try to get help that you make sure that they send a letter to a government official to tell them that. They don't have to put your own return address on it, so you won't be arrested. But it shows later on that you didn't desert, that you actually went AWOL to get help. In this case, she didn't do that. She didn't know about it, and she received the dishonorable discharge. So here she was sexually assaulted, combat veteran, and got no help after that. These people are in our society, lots of them. And just so you know, it's not a post 9/11 issue. I've met people who were deployed to Somalia, people who were deployed to the DMZ in Korea in the 70s, people who were in the Cold War in Europe, and Vietnam, obviously Vietnam veterans. And I even have a World War II veteran with a discharge like this, which we're still trying to upgrade right now. So Jerry was drafted and deployed to Vietnam. More than half of his unit died while I was there. And he was sitting, like many were at the time, was sitting on the porch and in Vietnam, and one of his buddies walked up from behind him and just sort of tapped him on the shoulder. "Hey, Jerry," and he attacked him. You know, I don't know if you know this, but you never like, even service members will never wake each other up by touching, you know, they throw a sock across the room or something to try to wake them up. So he attacked his buddy, and he was arrested and convicted for assault and received a dishonorable discharge. Of course, during Vietnam, there was very little help available still for PTSD. It wasn't really recognized as much yet. So what options do these veterans have? First of all, they can attempt to receive an administrative decision from the VA Medical Center so that they get a decision that they served honorably until their service-connected mental health problem made it impossible for them to do so. Okay. Then the second thing they can do is to attempt to upgrade the discharge. So you have to approve, as a veteran, you have to prove to the appropriate discharge review board that your discharge reason or characterization was inequitable or improper. Requires a ton of paperwork, mental health assessments, statements by family members, friends, buddies, everything. So it's a huge collection of paperwork that you have to do, and you have to tell your story over and over. So barriers, we already talked some about that. They're not eligible for VA care. Mainstream mental health care is not necessarily prepared to see them either. I don't know if you've ever worked in an ER, but I've worked in just general ERs for a while, and there were always veterans that came in, and they were never asked if they were a veteran. So the whole question of combat and PTSD and all of that was never asked. They have difficulty to obtain health insurance through employment because and other than honorable discharge makes it difficult to get employment in the first place. I mean, we're looking at veterans, somebody said this earlier, who have a higher unemployment rate than the general population. But these people have this DD-214, this discharge paper that says that they didn't serve honorably. And it's like they have a criminal conviction. Okay. Many of these veterans report being unable to take action because their mental health problems make it very difficult for them to attempt to get all this paperwork together and figure out what the process is. It's very, very complicated. Many are homeless and move frequently. So even if they start the process, then the mail comes in and they've already moved to another place. They don't have then they miss deadlines and then they lose their opportunity there. A lot of mental health providers, we don't know who they are. I mean, obviously I couldn't get any numbers of who has these kind of discharges and much less where they are. And I find that there's a lot of self-medication, criminal activity, unemployment, homelessness, marital problems, and much more among this population. So what I think that needs to happen is the military needs to become more aware of the reasons behind misconduct. So is this misconduct or is this mental health services? And this requires this whole cultural change that I think we're all talking about in the military that took forever in civilian society, right? Can we get mental health care without being called crazy? So in the military, it's going to take even longer to get that cultural change happening. And it's happening, but way too slow for this population. The military needs to remove barriers to treatment. They're working on that. I don't get as often anymore recent veterans that say that they were denied behavioral health care. A lot of them were from earlier in the war. The VA needs to simplify the process to assess eligibility for veterans with OTH discharges. So instead of putting up these huge barriers to figure out whether or not these people might become eligible, they should make it a little easier for people and a little more streamlined. VSOs, Veteran Service Officers, they are the people who usually help veterans with filling out their benefits paperwork. They're wonderful people. They know a lot about the regular benefits for regularly discharged people. They need help learning how to do discharge upgrades very, very badly. I do this almost every day that I talk to a VSO to teach them how to do a discharge upgrade. And then the process for upgrading a discharge needs to be simplified. Now, I'm not saying that every veteran with an other than honorable discharge should be eligible for an upgrade. I'm sure there is criminal activity there, but the ones I've seen, it's not. It's almost always a mental health problem. So, in conclusion, there are many veterans with service-connected mental health problems who are unable to access VA benefits, including mental health treatments. And these people become a burden on the criminal justice system, homelessness services, emergency rooms, public mental health care, and much, much more. They are they come into our emergency rooms, our homeless shelters, and our clinics, and everywhere else. So, thank you.
And we have time for some questions. A couple of things came up for me. Hans talked about the gentleman who got a bad conduct discharge or an other than honorable discharge because he was hypervigilant and attacked somebody, which tied in with one of the things that was on one of Steve's slides where he pointed out that one of the WTUs was placed near a firing range. Loud noises are not the friend of veterans. Not at all. Some states have state veterans benefits offices that will help with discharge upgrades. New Jersey is one. Not all states do, but if they exist in your state, by all means, you should use them. And then I'm just going to point out the one catch-22 for the people with other than honorable discharges. Civilian insurance, even if people obtain civilian insurance, does not cover results of acts of war. So that even if these people get gold standard civilian insurance, get good jobs, say they came home and battled through all their demons and got a degree and wound up working for the state of New Jersey, my insurance in New Jersey, Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield, specifically excludes effects any condition that resulted from an act of war. So that even with gold standard insurance, they can't access paid health care for PTSD, traumatic brain injury, or even, say, an amputation.
I can just interject.
Come on up.
One of the things that hasn't been discussed is the whole issue with the other than honorable discharge of the ECDs. That is Title 38 of the U.S. Code. Okay, that is a congressional decree. It that's really the only remedy. I think that's, it's not, mean old Bernie or Big Daddy Media not wanting to help a bunch of veterans. In fact, it's explicitly in the 1038 of the U.S. Code that there are numerous advocacy organizations that even folks within VA have repeatedly over the years tried to streamline this process and make those kind of congressional, legislative fixes, and they've gone just about nowhere. So, I think that needs to be discussed. Mm-hmm. This is not just by administrative fiat that, a bunch of, kind of capricious bureaucrats are trying to stick it to a bunch of guys. I mean, this is an act of Congress that created this regime.
Bob. I have a few questions. Maybe Steve can get first cut on them. What would you all see the implications of the current budget skirmishing, of the sequestering of the budgets on these legacy problems in terms of dealing with that? The other question is probably more conjecture, but what is the implication of all of this legacy on the reported moves to move more towards drone warfare?
Okay, well, the first one, again, I'm speaking now as a private citizen. OMB, Office of Management Budget, has come out of this on a sequestration basis, and to be able to emerge from that process is needs to go over that cliff, if you will, unmolested. That is kind of, at least what the public can put out. But I'm not going to go much further, on that. We have seen within VA a massive kind of infusion of funds, certainly over the last 4 years. And that's a great credit to our secretary. I think he has some real gravitas and credibility having the chief of staff of the Army to really kind of try to help us and get the resources, where we need. I'm not going to go there with the drone warfare thing, but that's a little bit outside my micro scope.
Well, as far as I talked about, and she brought this up, I've never been told about that.
You know what
I
said?
No, it's okay. No, it's fine. So, my concern about the budget really is, if I think about the effects on families, and we all know that the effects on families affect the individual, and soldiers whose families leave them because they can't stand the stress, that also affects their health care and ability to reintegrate and recover. So my concern is that and she brought this up, I don't know what what's the eligibility for family members if they're having mental health issues or children are having behavioral health issues. And there was money in the White House budget up until at least through last year dedicated to military families. So I suspect it was more about logistics than about accessing any kind of care. There's family support while people are deployed. But my concern about the budget is, yes, the VA budget has been, by many people, been declared off-limits. There's a battle over who is willing to fund the military more than who is not. I don't know that any of that affects families, and that, to me, is sort of the broader community effect of the courts.
The other thing about the budget is that while the VA healthcare system is indeed not on the table right this minute, the veterans' job still is. Other veteran services are definitely on the table, and hugely. And I just wanted to make one comment about Steve's discussion of the law around that other than honorable discharge. Steve, I don't think any of us are disagree with that. Hans herself said that we see a selected group that almost all have mental health issues that may have contributed to that. We're not denying that there are people who have other than honorable discharges that deserve them. We understand that the law needs to be.
Oh, I understand, but that was just completely omitted from the talk. I just thought that was a helpful kind of framework for the audience who may not be familiar with the issue.
I agree. Any other questions? Yes.
This is for Major Johnson. So, I think there's some valid concerns with WTUs, but I'd be curious to know why you think the medical was a preferable system of care, because there definitely was widespread problems apart from just Walter Reed.
With the med hold unit going far back. No, there wasn't. So why do you think that's a preferable system? There was a question about the preferability of going back to the med hold concept, instead of the WQs. I think in preparing for this talk, I had a sit down with General Zanakis, a retired commander of Southern Regional Medical Commander in the Army. He also commanded a Blanchfield Army Hospital in Fort Campbell. And we had just talked about his own experiences as a commander, both at the command level as well as at the facility level, and the benefits of having certainly incidents in 03 and specifically in Fort Stewart, and some other issues at Wood, I think, as well, and also Fort Knox. But again, that was just a, I think a lot of that was the ramifications of the real surge of patients, and also at the same time, we were seeing these Army-directed illicit conversions where the hospital commanders really had to assume a lot of risk as far as the quality of NCOs and officers they could dedicate to that role. But I think if that's viewed as, if we were to view that as sacrosanct, as kind of the WTU model, would, I think it would be more helpful. These are people who know the medical system, they're medical soldiers, and you know, one of the most pernicious things that's come out of the whole WTU model is this mythology that medical personnel, medical officers, medical NCOs lack the awareness and understanding of combat soldiers to take care of them. Well, you know, most male medical NCOs started their careers, you know, as linemen with infantry armor companies. Afterwards, most medical service corps male officers like myself, you know, like 2 years of life every battalion. So I mean, I bristle, you know, with the idea that that we don't get it. But thank you very much for the question.
Any other questions? No?
Yes.
Yes.
So, you mentioned an infection of reentry from combat and the criminal system. This has been happening a long time with the Vietnam era vets as well. And I wonder what your perception of veteran supports is and how well that veteran supports are coming out with that.
The question is about veterans courts and how they help out with vets who become involved with the criminal justice system.
I cannot talk about research because I'm not a researcher, but I can talk from personal experience. The man Eric in my presentation, when he was arrested, I tried to get him into the veterans court rather than the general criminal justice system, and it was very difficult. I called 6 times and did not get called back, even though I left messages and was promised by the machine that they would be called back. So there's still, you know, I think the concept is wonderful. I think the concept is, you know, that these veterans could get care rather than punishment, or maybe some of both. I think that, you know, we need more of that. But the accessibility, at least in Cook County, Illinois, has been a problem. And the other thing that worries me about it is, and that's another personal experience, that domestic violence does not fall under the Veterans Court. And that is one of the biggest issues that I come across with families, with military families or veterans families. So domestic violence, that is the biggest issue, is not falling under under Veterans Court. So that is still something to be worked on very hard. What I have liked in Chicago, that's where I work, is that the police has hired a number of veterans who are training each other now, or they're training their peers, their non-veteran peers, on PTSD, and they actually have veteran units so that if there's a veteran that, there's a call about a veteran that needs police intervention, they send a particular team that actually has some experience with veterans and has some knowledge of PTSD. So that has been another step in the right direction. I think, you know, all in all, there's a lot of good steps. It's just so difficult to actually practically implement it.
My experience with veterans courts has been very limited because in New Jersey we really don't have a whole lot of that. It's very, the geographical disparities are enormous. There are communities and states and counties that have veterans courts that recognize the differences, and there are other places that hugely resist this because it's giving special treatment to a class of people. And so it's tremendously varied. I think it certainly would be helpful for everyone, the medical system, our healthcare system, our criminal justice system, our the people who provide services for the welfare of people, the housing folks, the people who do shelters, the people who do food stamps, all of the groups should have an eye out for veterans who are in need and plug them into services for which they may very well qualify. Stupid veteran syndrome is not limited to people with jobs. There are people who are homeless who don't know they have benefits. There are people who come in for medical care who don't know they're eligible for VA benefits. or who had said, no, I don't want to do that for a variety of man-on-the-street vet syndrome reasons. And it's up to those of us who see them clinically to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, you can get services here. You know, you can't afford that. Well, yeah, you can. The VA will pay for it. That sort of thing.
The only thing I read that, but the thing that I was talking to some people recently from the National Women's Veterans Association about the veterans courts regarding as it related to them being victims of military sexual trauma. And in their case, they were optimistic about the idea of their cases, if they're, especially when their perpetrator was also in the military, being heard in a civilian setting versus in the military setting. My understanding also is that there is some legislation pending that they're actually, that the DOD is considering hearing any military sexual trauma cases, moving it over to under to be under civilian control. Because for a lot of these women, they don't report it. And again, I was saying earlier, a lot of these women are women who were assaulted 20 years ago. They are not just the current veterans, and they never felt they got justice, and of course it's created huge mental health problems, huge inability to social networks to function in our society. So they were optimistic. There's apparently a judge in Santa Ana, California, that has a really good reputation among the women veterans of hearing these cases and feeling like that she really, you know, and there was the whole issue of whether the judge is male or female.
Any other questions? Once again, this is just my own personal take on this. I think philosophically, the veterans courts maybe where they're going right now, or I think it's a good idea, but it is, I think, a slippery slope that I think has to be careful with. I think we have to be very careful about the emergence of, again, this special treatment of the special class of folks. We're all public health professionals. I mean, there are a lot of contributing factors to all kinds of things, of domestic violence, income security, you know, people's jobs. I mean, in this kind of economy, I think there's a larger issue there. I think it's very, we need to be very cautious not to kind of, that's something that needs to be looked at before we go too far down the road.
Any other questions? Let me remind you that a lot of us are also part of the Peace Caucus. Our brochures are here. We have several sessions coming up. All of them are going to be great. The next one is at 4:30 this afternoon, LCC South. 12:30 this afternoon, MCC South, following 302, and it's War, Terrorism, and Public Health. It's going to be an amazing, Dick Seidel, Barry Levy, great people. Come up, get the brochures, come to the sessions, join the Peace Conference. Thank you for coming.